People see things differently, or they see different things when they look at forests. Where some people see a place for recreation and habitat and potential carbon sequestration, other people see value in the timber, value realized by taking the trees out of the forest and selling them as lumber and plywood and more. That basic tension will probably always exist. But when you think of forests strictly in terms of climate change, the equations change a bit. Recent research out of Oregon State University considered the lush forests of Western Oregon relative to climate change. The research provides insight and numbers on the value of forests for carbon sequestration, the level of emissions put out by the timber industry, and more. The lead author is Beverly Law, professor of global change biology and terrestrial systems science in the Department of Forest Ecosystems and Society, and she's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Hi, Dr. Law.
Hello, Jeffrey. Thank you for having me.
Very good to have you. You start out by pointing out that there are proposals for forest activities to mitigate carbon emissions. Are we still early in putting any of those proposals to work on the ground?
Yes, we are. And it's really the low-hanging fruit because when we're, you know, the main problem that we have is we need to reduce carbon dioxide emissions in the, to the atmosphere as quickly as possible and start now. But a lot of the technologies that are being developed will take quite some time to get in place. And they've been shown to, you know, projections are showing they'll be nowhere near doing it. And yet we have some of the highest carbon density forests in the world. And our forests here have so much more potential to increase carbon on the land. And so carbon on the land means it's not in the atmosphere.
So when we talk about activities involving these forests, I mean, are we talking about potentially non-activities too, like just leaving the forests alone to grow?
Yes, that's right. So, and we tested several scenarios of what you might do. And it includes just letting, one of the scenarios we tested was looking at just reserving public lands, about 50% of the public lands, that carbon in those forests. Reserving that means not cutting it, just let it grow. And then also increasing harvest, or the amount of time that you go between harvesting forests. So on private lands. And so that means we increased it from 45 years to over 80 years. And those combined increase the amount of carbon we can store into the future the most. But we also looked at reforesting areas that are that were forested within the past 30 to 50 years, and they're just regrowing. And then we also tried a scenario of using a non-food grass crop, about 170,000 hectares, and regrowing natural forest that had been there more than 50 years ago. So that was afforestation scenario.
I was going to ask you about afforestation because that was the term that's relatively new to me anyway. That represents putting forest where there isn't forest now?
Yeah, and in this case, you know, when you talk about afforestation, the technical definition is it hasn't been a forest for at least 50 years. And in the Willamette Valley and a lot of areas, but particularly in the Willamette Valley, that area was forest a long time ago, 100 years or more ago. So all we did was take a portion of that area and allowed that to regrow in this Earth system model that we're running. And then we determined what could the carbon, how much carbon could those forests take up from the atmosphere annually to the year 2100.
So, Beverly, when you talk about how Western Oregon has some of the highest carbon density forests in the world, is it simply based on biomass or, you know, surface area of needles and leaves? I mean, or function of all those things?
So we look at when they say carbon density, they mean the amount of biomass per unit area ground. And then what we also look at is how much goes into the atmosphere and how much is taken up by forests, and then we determine the net of that. So there are plant processes and soil processes, and we determine what that net amount of carbon is that these forests take up annually. And then we subtract from that any losses from fire, harvest, insects to get this net ecosystem carbon balance of the forest.
So you plugged in different variables, it sounds like, into this equation and figured out what the net ecosystem carbon loss or gain would be?
Right, and we did that for recent years. So we used a combination of inventory data. We have plots all over Oregon, and we have actual flux sites all over Oregon. So we combined a lot of information and determined that right now our annual net ecosystem carbon balance, even after you account for fire losses and harvest, say for the years 2011 to 2015, that amount, that was about the equivalent to about 70% of our total greenhouse gas or carbon dioxide emissions for the state. I wouldn't say total greenhouse gases because that includes other gases.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying the forests are able to take up 70% of that?
Yeah, they're doing that now. But we can increase that amount and into the future. So what we do is we run into the future this model that accounts for climate change effects on forests, and we determine what that net ecosystem carbon balance might be in the future and how we could increase it beyond business as usual management. So all we did was we ran it with our current management practices, and then we ran it with these land use change scenarios and determined how much it could be increased from what we're currently doing, but doing this under future climate conditions. A lot of previous analyses that have been done haven't taken into account climate change.
So when you figured up future climate conditions, did you figure up higher temperatures, less rainfall, both of those and other things as well?
Yes. There are models that are developed globally, about 45 of them, and the ones that are most appropriate for our region. These are just climate models. We use that as input. And they include a lot of those variables. Everything you can think of, wind, et cetera, goes into this. And so when we do the projections forward, we're actually showing that Oregon's forests overall will have an increase in net carbon uptake, and that outweighs the amount of whatever loss you might have that's due to fire. And the increase is because the increased longer growing season, increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere makes photosynthesis more efficient. And so that's benefiting more of the wetter forests. The drier forests might see a little more fire, but overall, our net ecosystem carbon balance is going to increase in the future, even if we continue as business as usual, because the some of the benefits that we gain from climate change.
So let me get that. That's a really big point. So if we just keep doing what we're doing right now, we'll actually see some gains in our carbon sequestration?
Yes.
Wow. Beverly Law is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from Oregon State University. The name of the paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science published in March is Land Use Strategies to Mitigate Climate Change in Carbon-Dense Temperate Forests. She's the lead author. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I think you were about to say something there when I gave the restate.
That's quite all right. Yeah, I was going to say, and we are accounting for projections of future wildfire. So I think a lot of people think, well, aren't you doing? Yeah, we're accounting for that.
Well, okay. All right, so that's in there too. But the longer growing season is a really interesting point to me, because I know that some people have pointed out that, you know, there will be some benefits to be had from global warming, and I guess that's one of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the benefits and there are costs, but the net effect, at least for Oregon, we're lucky. Other parts of the country are not like this. But we're in a good location, and so it looks like we'll have some net benefits.
So I want to ask about the computer models themselves, because you have to plug your basic data into some assumptions you're making about, okay, this activity might do this, and then the computer models take it from there. But are these off-the-shelf things you buy from someplace else? I mean, I'm just wondering how much work has to go on with your team into looking at the assumptions in the models themselves.
An amazing amount of work, because they're models that we use more observations than the average modeler. So this model is one out of the National Climate and Atmospheric Research Center, NCAR, in Colorado. And there are teams of modelers around the world who work on improving this model, constantly work on improving the model. And we've improved it for regional applications. And so we're really contributing, because you think that globally, like these global assessments of climate change are going to have to get down to the scale that we're working at. So we use a lot of observations, and we compare our model results with observations for the contemporary period, the recent years, in terms of how much carbon the forests are taking up and wildfires. We also compare the wildfire model with observations for the past 30 years. So it's a lot of work, and you know, we've been working on this with this particular model for about 10 years.
All right, I'm just curious to know how carefully you challenge the assumptions of the models themselves, and it sounds like you go pretty deep into the math there, and there's lots of it.
Yeah, we're deep into it. As a lot of people say, regional is hard, because you really do need to bring the observations into the analysis, and it's a lot of remote sensing observations, land observations, inventories. we bring all of that into it. We're our own worst critics.
Which is a good way to be, because then you find the mistakes before anybody else does.
Yeah.
Right. So you did mention, Beverly, dry forests in addition to the moist forests. So what, when we talk about this portion of Western Oregon, what are we actually talking about?
So west of the Cascades.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's pretty much the wetter area. We have really, we call it really high soil water holding capacity. So even when you have bad years like 2015, they still have access to deep soil water. So that water carries them through some events like that.
So it seems like a lot of the mainstream media tended to pick up on the fact that the timber industry seems to put out a lot of carbon emissions. And give us the sense of what you found there and the relative importance of that.
Yeah, so what happens is, and we have a life cycle assessment, so once we've run the model, we have this assessment that tracks carbon through its use. And so there are data on the amount or the fraction that goes into long-term wood products and short-term products and so forth. And then there are national level and regional level data on the rate at which that material, once it goes into that product, how long it takes to decompose, and so that it's, you know, giving off carbon to the atmosphere all through the process. And that includes the amount of energy and carbon that's used to harvest, and that's used in manufacturing, the carbon that's lost in manufacturing from the wood as you're processing the wood. And then it includes the mill use of that carbon, any mill waste that they might use and emit to the atmosphere through burning, and then onwards to landfill. So it tracks all of that. The life cycle assessment tracks all that. And then we also give credit for substituting for more carbon-intensive materials like steel and concrete and buildings.
Because those take even more carbon to manufacture?
Yeah, mm-hmm. They can, but you have to know just what portion of our buildings go into concrete and steel. So that's accounted for, and that's called the substitution benefit. So we take that into account, too.
Wow. The amount of data is just staggering. Beverly Law, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from Oregon State University, Land Use Strategies to Mitigate Climate Change in Carbon-Dense Temperate Forests, the study for which she is the lead author. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So as you looked at the different mixes of land use, you talked about that one of the scenarios involving longer rotations, particularly on private land. So this is not just public land we're talking about here. Going from what is now usually a 45-year, I think you said, or so rotation to more like 80 or 100 years. So we're talking about not as much disturbance of areas that are being logged now.
Yes, and, you know, I was around here. I've been in Oregon for 30 years, and I've been working in forests for longer than that. But the rotations used to be longer. But, see, the thing is that the longer you keep it on the ground, the longer it'll stay out of the atmosphere. And so if you were to increase it to 80 years, it's a large amount of carbon that you're able to store by doing that and keep out of the atmosphere. And the interesting thing is we also analyzed data. This was about 10 years ago, where we looked at how much carbon can be, or how does annual net carbon uptake, or annual net primary productivity in particular, where does that peak? In a lot of these forests, it peaks around 80 to 100 years. And another study that was separate, but we included that information in here because it's in the same region, and that is that the biodiversity of animals and forest species in general really starts to increase after about 80 years. So that's a kind of a co-benefit of keeping it on the ground longer.
I'm still struck by the basic finding here, which is the NECB, the Net Ecosystem Carbon Balance. It was taking up 72% of total emissions in the year's study. This is 2011 to 2015. Mm-hmm. And that's, you say that the ability of the forest to take up the carbon will increase by the year 2100 with little change in wildfires?
Yeah. So there'll be little change in wildfires, you know, or precipitation. Like I was saying, this is the best place to live if you were to live anywhere in the country. It's estimated, you know, that precipitation will maybe increase or decrease by 10%, which isn't very much. And so we ran these different climate models, but in this particular study, we just showed the one that matches our observations more closely. And so you end up not having as much wildfires in the future. And when we were looking in the net ecosystem carbon balance, again, when you look at the carbon dioxide, increased carbon dioxide makes the trees more efficient at taking carbon out of the atmosphere. And likewise, having the longer growing seasons allows them to take it up more throughout the year. And so, and things like Douglas fir, if you think about Douglas fir, we've made leaf level measurements on those trees, and almost year-round, if the temperature gets up above freezing, they can start taking carbon up.
Wow. So one thing I want to ask about before we go, which is whether you took up specifically the oft discussed practice of thinning, either commercial thinning or pre-commercial thinning, where we go in and remove some of the excess material that is there because of all the years of fire suppression. And was that accounted for in your study?
Yeah, so when I talked about the business as usual management, mm-hmm. that's in there. So we run the model forward into time, into the future, and we account for that kind of management practice. Whatever has been done in the past, we account for that. And so when we come back through and add in these land use strategies, we see how that has improved above business as usual management.
So, Beverly, about a minute left. What do you want people to take away from this? What's the major finding that you think should be the guiding star for people on this?
We can do a lot to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by just implementing some rather conservative land use strategies in our forests, because we have some of the best high carbon density forests in the world. So if we can implement those, it'll help us meet our greenhouse gas targets.
Okay. Oregon west of the Cascades is what we're talking about here. That was the area studied. The publication is called Land Use Strategies to Mitigate Climate Change in Carbon-Dense Temperate Forests, and that does describe Western Oregon pretty well. In the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, published in March, Beverly Law, one of, it looks like, about eight authors, the lead author on it. She's at Oregon State University's Department of Forest Ecosystems and Society, professor of Global Change Biology and Terrestrial Systems Science. Beverly, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
All right. Thank you, Jeffrey.